This episode is brought to you by Mind Happy. We all spend way too much time in front of our screens. I know I do. And I find myself craving creative yet restful analog activity. I never thought I would long for the downtime of my childhood in the 90s making friendship bracelets at summer camp. This is why we were so excited when we discovered Mind Happy. Mind Happy is a lifestyle and wellness brand centered on thoughtful creativity to help people craft fulfilling moments, connections, and self-care rituals through purposeful play. Mind Happy provides curated monthly deliveries that promote phone-free activities like knitting, coloring, and crafting. Each delivery provides everything you need to explore new hobbies, promote mindfulness, and foster togetherness. They believe that play is one of the most effective ways to relax and re-energize in our daily lives.
Mind Happy's founder is an ex-Amazon executive who leveraged similar activities to alleviate her own burnout. It takes a creative approach to mental health through psychology-backed activities, sparking everyday inspiration and joy, and all activities are selected based on science, restoring mental clarity, energizing connections, reducing anxiety, and facilitating fulfilling moments. Think of it as a curated monthly self-care delivered to your door. We also love that products from each box are primarily sourced from small women-owned businesses, and they can be tailored towards individual discovery or shared group activities, perfect for a small dinner party. For 15% off your first month subscription, go to mindhappy.com. That's mindhappy.com and use code COURAGE15 at checkout.
Welcome to Courageous Wellness. My name is Erica Stein.
And I'm Allie French. And this is a podcast about individual journeys within wellness and how to navigate it all.
After Allie experienced a cancer diagnosis in her 20s,
and Erica went through a self-love journey, we created a platform to interview real people from all walks of life that have combined all types of practices. From physical wellness to emotional and spiritual, we hear courageous stories and focus on why it's important to share them.
We are both certified integrative nutrition health coaches, and together with our community, are learning to live our most purposeful lives by sharing one courageous story at a time.
It takes courage to share these journeys, and by talking about them, we aim to destigmatize the process. We want you to be your own health advocate, feel educated and informed on the latest in health and wellness, and empower you to feel your absolute best.
And because we want to bring forth a wide variety of stories, the opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect our own, but we hope the diverse and varied stories will empower you to make the best choices for your own life. So join us as we and our community share our courageous wellness.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Courageous Wellness. We have a really interesting episode for you this week with Annabelle Abstreets, and we're going to talk all about sleeplessness and her new book, but it's going to be about sleep in a different way, not in the way that we usually approach the sleep topic, which is how to get more of it or how to get better quality sleep, but it's about what to do when we embrace the night self, when we're dealing with insomnia, and how we can actually make it work for us and leverage it creatively. So that's really interesting. We'll get to that in just a second. I just wanted to share that we have an exciting update. Erica and I are now on the Cloud 10 Network. So Courageous Wellness Podcast is now a part of the Cloud 10 Network with wonderful other shows. Check them out. We're excited to be a part of the family. And yeah, that's our big news. So what were we going to say?
I was going to say, it's so exciting. Yeah. And I'm big fans of the shows on the network. You know me too. I'm like a big Vanderpump Rules girl. And I saw that Kristen Doty's podcast is also on the network. If you're a Vanderpump gal like me, but they also have other great wellness podcasts like Lucy Fink's show, Kat Sadler. We're just excited to be a part of the network and, you know, continue to bring you incredible episodes every Wednesday with amazing guests like Annabelle today. And yeah, we're excited. So yes.
And so as part of our normal weekly update, we thought we would share some of our own sleep updates with our theme this week with Annabelle. So before we get into her formal intro, Erica, do you want to share with us what is your sleep update?
My sleep update. I was telling Allie, I'm so sleepy right now as we record, because as our listeners know, I've been deep. I'm kind of in, I've always been a pretty big reader, but I will say since summer of this year, it's been a really consistent part of my self-care routine. And I love reading before bed. And I know, and again, we're going to talk a lot about sleeplessness and kind of embracing and leaning into that part of yourself. But I've historically been a good sleeper. And I know, though, I have really vivid and intense dreams. And so the content I actually consume before bed can be really important. And that's why I like to read before bed, because it's kind of like a nice wind down, or I'm in this like creative new fantasy land. But I finished, you know, I'm in my fantasy era, and I finished the last maybe 200 pages of the Crescent City number one, Crescent City House of Earth and Blood, the new, it's part of the Sarah J. Maas multiverse, if you've heard me talk about this. And I finished at like maybe 12:30 a.m. you know, and I've stayed up to like three reading these like last 200 pages sometimes, and I'm so tired. But my update is I had the craziest dreams. Like I literally was like in that universe in my dreams, and it wasn't great actually. So now I'm like, maybe I need to like finish the last 200 pages of a fantasy book not before bed.
In the middle of the night.
But I did want to give an update on the Crescent City book number one, because I know ACOTAR is the Sarah J. Maas book universe that a lot of people get into. And then it's like, should I read Throne of Glass next? Should I read the Crescent City series? Because they all kind of, you know, it's a multiverse. But and Crescent City kind of had a lot of like interesting hype of like, it's not as good, or you have to read 200, 300 pages before it gets good, because it's like a 700 page book. And I just have to say, I really enjoyed it. And it's a mystery, and I love a mystery. And it's less spicy than like the ACOTAR series. But again, I'm like one of the only people who's in it for like the world, the world building. But no, I really enjoyed Crescent City. So if you're hesitant to like read it or start it because you've heard that kind of messaging of, oh, it takes like 300 pages to get into. It was a slower read, but I liked it from the get-go. So I don't know what people are talking about, or maybe because they have that hype around it, I just enjoyed it more. I didn't have, you know, expectations, but I loved it. And so now I'm going to start. Three of them have been released. The third was just released in January. So no spoilers. I like have to avoid my TikTok like crazy until I read all three, but I'm going to start. I think it's House of Sky and Breath is Crescent City number two, and I'm looking forward to it, but just not before bed. So that's like my sleep.
No dragon fantasy. Dreams.
No. Yeah. No dragon dreams. So Allie, what is your little sleep update this week?
Mine is different. Actually mine's a little bit more sort of like biological, but I've shared this on the podcast, but I've been fully on the mouth taping trend. And there's a lot of science behind it. And actually we have a great episode coming up. We've recorded it already, but, it'll keep an eye out for it. It's with Dr. Katie Lee, who's, a dentist, and we talk about the benefits of mouth taping. But I have to say, I feel like the quality of my sleep is vastly improved. And I didn't even know that it was like poor, but now it's like the dreaming that happens too. It's like really wild. And along with the other benefits for our, like the way we breathe and the nitric oxide and all that stuff. But my husband just started mouth taping too after I've been in it for a little while. And he's having wild dreams too. But he likened it to when we both started taking magnesium before bed, like that kind of like next level sort of support in the sleep process. And I can't say enough good stuff about it, but that's actually not what our episode is about today.
It's actually about leaning in when you can't sleep,
yeah,
and like the creative benefits of insomnia. And it's actually really, I learned a lot on this episode that
Me
I
too.
Didn't know.
Me too. So should we get into it?
Yes, let's do it.
So today we welcome bestselling author Annabelle Abstreets on her new book, Sleepless, Unleashing the Subversive Power of the Night Self, a remarkable blend of memoir, science, and history that traces women's relationship with the darkness, grief, insomnia, and the productive, creative opportunities waiting in wakefulness. In 2020, Abstreets struggled with a dizzying descent into the black hole of insomnia after startling deaths in her family in quick succession. Like many women, the author believed that she'd simply power through that grief and pain, but she soon discovered that tenacity was not the key to healing. Instead, she refused drugs and sleep aids and stopped fighting her internal demons. She eventually learned to embrace what she calls her night self, where her wakeful, naturally altered night brain offered solace and serenity.
Lyrical and meticulously researched, Sleepless is groundbreaking in its focus and depth on the subject of insomnia and disrupted sleep. In this episode, we discuss the latest science of how circadian rhythms, especially in women, change the awake at night brain, discuss this idea of a night self, and listen as Annabelle presents a new way of seeing one's wakeful nights, not as doom and gloom, but as an opportunity for reflection and creativity. She truly shares a gentle and comprehensive blueprint for disconnecting from the anxiety of insomnia to recapture strength, imagination, and finally, the ability to sleep. We hope you enjoy the episode. This episode is brought to you by BTR Nation. BTR is a female-founded brand that is on a mission to end mindless snacking with their protein bars with a purpose. Snacks get a bad reputation, high in sugar, ingredients you can't pronounce, ultra processed. But what if you had a snack that checked all the right boxes? A snack with a purpose. Because when we snack mindfully, when we honor our bodies, our hunger, our snackiness, we transform our mindset. BTR bars and chocolate truffle cups are made with no gluten, no dairy, no soy, no added sugar, no corn or rice syrups, no GMOs, no natural flavors, no sugar alcohols, no stevia, no inflammatory ingredients, and no gums or fillers. The cleanest label in the category. They only use ingredients that you can pronounce and adaptogenic superfoods like reishi, lion's mane, and cordyceps.
They also taste delicious. I always have the peanut butter chocolate chip bliss bars in my cabinet, and Erica doesn't go a day without having the dark chocolate truffle cups. Besides the many delicious snacks to choose from, we love the story of BTR. Founder and owner Ashley Marie found inspiration in an unlikely place at an unlikely time, at the hospital cafeteria. When both of her parents were diagnosed with cancer, her life turned upside down as she became their caretaker, and her own nutrition began to suffer. Ashley was devouring protein bars when she could, as many of us do, to fit in a meal or a snack. Most of the bars she quickly discovered were filled with sugar. After her parents passed away, she founded a bar brand based on their family mantra: be bold, tenacious, and resilient.
If you want to try BTR bars and truffle cups, you can save 20% on your order with code COURAGEOUSWELLNESS. All one word, at btrnation.com. You can also find this link in our show notes and Linktree on Instagram. Welcome, Annabelle. We are very excited to have this conversation with you and talk about your book. But before we get into it, can you share with us a little bit about your personal background and how it led into the world of writing and sleep?
Yeah, so well, I've been a writer for about, 10 years or so. And I've also, for the last 10 years, been blogging about health on a website called The Age Well Project, which also, we also produced a book called The Age Well Project. So I've been looking at ways of, I guess, really just helping women to, I say age, but we started when we were in our 40s. And so we thought that was a sort of critical, the 40s, and that time when you're really busy, you know, with, you've got young kids, you've got teenagers, and you're looking after elderly parents, that time when you're really, really busy is absolutely the time when you should be looking after yourself, but of course you're not. So our focus was, you know, how can you find, yeah, little easy hacks while you're really busy and working and being a parent and doing everything else, little easy hacks that you could fit into your busy day to ensure that come 10, 20 years, you don't end up with dementia because we all know that, you know, dementia, it presents when you're in your 60s, 70s and 80s, but actually it starts, it takes hold in your brain, you know, in your 20 years before it starts presenting. So that, if, you know, if it presents in the 70s, then in your 70s, then you're actually living with it in your 50s. So the plan was to try and help everyone to stop things like that in their tracks. So I was doing that. And I was also writing fiction and nonfiction. And I had four children, and I'd had insomnia for about 25 years. And so I had sort of learned to live with it. Sometimes I took sleeping pills. I tried not to, though. And it was sort of mild and manageable insomnia. And then, as I write about in the book, which is sort of jumping ahead a bit, the insomnia, a series of things happened to me, which we can talk about. And the insomnia just leapt to new heights. And I had to think long and hard about how I was going to cope with it. So then I ended up in this place. In fact, I was already commissioned to write a book about how women were more creative at night. So I had that sort of bubbling away. But that book then had to completely change direction, really, because my insomnia was so bad that I thought I can't just, it was going to be a little funny book. I thought I can't just write a funny book because this is really not funny. So that was about 3 years ago. And so I started working for 3 years. I've worked solidly on this book, looking at the science of sleep and insomnia, and particularly the I guess you'd call it the neuroscience of the brain that is awake at night. And there's been a ton of research on the sleeping brain. So we now all know about how, you know, in sleep, the brain cycles through these sort of, you know, 90-minute phases. And we know that we've got more deep sleep and less REM sleep. And then this changes over the course of the night. So all of that fantastic research has been great. We now understand the sleeping brain. And the research into sleep deprivation has also been fantastic. That's been really heavily funded. So we all know about the dangers of sleep deprivation. But the brain that is awake at night has not been studied at all until about, I think it was 2 years ago, the first big study of what is actually happening in the brain when it's awake in the middle of the night. This study came out, and I think it was produced by maybe about 10, a really big group of quite eminent sleep scientists who had got together, and it was called The Mind After Midnight. And that dropped onto my desk just as I was in the middle of this book and thinking, you know, I've got all these ideas about what is happening in my own head at night. And I know about all of these women going back hundreds of years. So I was looking back to, you know, 16th century women who had written about their own insomnia. And I was looking at women who just got up in the night and did things, and women, of course, who had had, you know, 10, 12 children and how they coped with it. And all of this had been documented really just in letters and private journals and diaries. So I was pulling that all together. But I didn't have any, you know, solid scientific evidence that said this is what is happening in the brain, and particularly the female brain, which I was specifically interested in for reasons that we can come on to. And so when this report arrived, I got in touch with the main researcher, and, you know, for a couple of years we just to and fro, just bouncing ideas around, because there's still not very much research, but we are starting to understand a lot more now about not only the awake at night brain, but also the difference between the male brain and the female brain awake at night, and the difference between what men need in terms of sleep and what women need. And it's really quite different. And so this is, you know, still very, very early days, but it's really fascinating. So that's how I came. It's a very long answer to your question. That's how I came to write about sleep and insomnia. So the book is quite a lot of my own personal story. But of course, everyone is completely different in how they deal with insomnia, how they deal with sleep deprivation. So it's very much my story. But I then look at all of the women through the ages, really, but particularly women who got up at night, was what I found. My insomnia was so bad, I really thought, okay, I've got two options. So I lost my, this is in the pandemic, I lost my father, my stepfather, a puppy. And then there was another death that I didn't put in the book because it was sort of too much, really. But my daughter her friend took his own life. So all of this happened in the space of about 6 weeks. And because I had a bereaved mother who was completely on her own in the pandemic, isolated, I had a bereaved stepmother completely on her own. All the kids, you know, hadn't seen their friends for months. So we all know what it was like. It was just awful. Yeah. I thought I had to keep the show on the road. I thought, this is down to me. I've got to hold everything together. I've got to look after my mom. I've got to look after my stepmom. They're all in isolation. They're all grieving. I've got to look after my kids who are distraught. And this, you know, tragedy with this puppy that we had inadvertently bought from a puppy mill. And we just had no idea. And that was just horrible. Yeah. So I took the whole of that huge weight on my shoulders as you know, as mothers often do, particularly in that situation. You just think, it's all down to me. It's all down to me. And what happened was I kept really, really busy during the day, which was also partly a coping mechanism. And I was just trying to keep the show on the road. But at night, I suddenly... Not only could I not sleep, but I suddenly really needed to be in the dark. And I didn't really understand why. But the darkness was very, very healing for me. And I didn't want to sleep. So when I sat there and I thought, look, I've got to either take some sleeping pills or I've just got to go with this feeling that I need the darkness and try and understand what it's giving me that I need so much. And just to go, I thought, I'm just going to go on that journey, on that journey and see where it goes, because I didn't want to be, you know, just all groggy with sleeping pills, which I don't like taking anyway. And when you've got really chronic insomnia, no amount of magnesium, no amount of herbal remedy, no amount of lavender oil, they're all lovely and they help relax you a little bit. But when you're really stressed and really grieving, they just don't work.
Yeah.
So, it's just no point even trying, because I'm just going to be so disappointed every time I try a new herbal remedy or a new supplement and it doesn't work. So I thought I'll just put them all to one side and I'll just see where this journey goes.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And you know, it's so interesting reading, especially the opening to your book. As you were saying, you really infuse your own experience, that the experience of kind of intense grief. And reading that, I could relate. There was a lot of, I think a lot of people went through extreme loss during the pandemic in many, many ways, but also dealt with a lot of family loss. And it was the way you write, you can tell you're a beautiful writer. You can tell you're also like a novelist, because it felt kind of there's this like memoir quality to it, while you're also exploring this idea of, you know, sleeplessness through the ages and what happens at night and to the night brain and the science and the new research that's gone along with that. And that was something that intrigued Erica and myself, because in the sort of space that we're in the wellness space, it's always about the importance of sleep. As we know, circadian rhythm, the infradian rhythm for women as well, and how that corresponds to the circadian rhythm. We, you know, it's always about if there's insomnia, like as you just mentioned, with all the sort of herbal remedies, what is the fix? Because that's the problem. The problem is the insomnia, right? And what's so unique about what you explored is when you stopped fighting it, and said, as you just said, like, I'm going to go on this journey and explore the darkness and explore what happens at night. You also kind of come across people through the ages, whether they're spiritual experiences or creative experiences that happened at night. And that was really fascinating, like embracing what everybody so fights all the time. And obviously there's like a health component for sleep, and obviously we need it. But there was something that I'd love you to talk a little bit about, which you touched on, is the female brain and like the hormones too. You said there's even some thought that there might be more resilience for women, you know, over time, even if it's biological, from a like dealing with newborns and caring, like he's talking about this intense sort of caretaker role that you took on.
Can you talk a little bit about what you discovered in that and from that uniquely sort of like female brain hormonal kind of research?
Yeah. So I think there are probably two things. So the first thing that really fascinated me was that within the female brain, we have larger and more active prefrontal cortexes. So the prefrontal cortex is the bit that sits, you know, here, just right behind your forehead. And it's the bit of the brain, I call it the command and control center, but it's the bit of the brain that is very orderly. It's very methodical. It does everything by the book. It's all about being sensible. So it's, you can understand why it's stronger in women, because, you know, we're so sort of, we've always been raised to sort of behave in a way that perhaps is less marked if you're a guy. So we follow all the rules. We're much more sort of law abiding in that respect. And, you know, and the prefrontal cortex keeps us thinking rationally and I guess just being very sensible. And the thing about that is it's not always conducive to creative thought. So for the imagination to really flourish and to be really creative, you really have to be pushing down the walls and, you know, not traveling in a straight line. So when we women with our large active prefrontal cortex, which is keeping the whole show on the road the whole time and juggling and making sure everything stays in the right track, when darkness comes down, and this, and we're very much bound to light and dark, when it starts to get dark and our prefrontal cortex starts to get tired, it goes into partial hibernation. So for a woman, if you can just put aside that ruminative voice that always comes in the middle of the night, if you can shut that voice down, you find, what I found certainly was that I could think much more imaginatively. And I found that inner critic that women have, or most women have, who is quite vocal, the inner critic. I think the inner critic comes from the prefrontal cortex, always saying, you can't do that. That's not for you. You know, you're not good enough to do that. So that sort of goes to sleep as well. And there's a sudden little window where you can try new things and your brain isn't saying, don't be stupid, you shouldn't be doing that. And you've also got, you know, the house is quiet. You've usually got people sleeping around you. So you don't go and unstack the dishwasher because that's noisy. So you really have to do things that are quiet and sort of lend themselves to something that is often a little bit more imaginative. So you can sit and do your admin, of course, but we all know that we're not supposed to be looking at screens. So that's brilliant. Because when you think, okay, I can't look at my phone, I can't look at my screen because of all that terrible blue light, then you pick up a notebook and you pick up a pen and you start to write by hand, which also is much more conducive to thinking imaginatively. And also, I think, much more conducive to sort of self-expression. So for someone like me who was grieving, I could get my journal out and things would come out in a way that was more, I think, more freeing and perhaps more honest and a little bit more imaginative. I was more open to exploring things. And I tried lots of other things, you know, drawing and painting and things that I would never have done during the day. Either I was too busy or the inner critic was saying, don't be silly. That's not what you do. So that was all quite cathartic. But then on the other side, the other aspect of that is this really interesting work's being done at Cambridge University at the moment. And it's looking at how women are much more resilient to broken nights or nights of broken sleep. So all of the headlines about the, you know, the risk of metabolic disease that comes with not sleeping properly isn't really so relevant to women. It's actually men. So men are much more at risk of metabolic disease from sleeping poorly than women. And when I spoke to the researcher about this, the researcher, he was a guy, and he said to me, well, this is obviously an evolutionary thing, because how on earth did women have, you know, baby after baby after baby, you're getting up, you're feeding through the night. Also, of course, women have always done all the caring roles. So whether that's looking after elderly parents or sick neighbours or whatever. And of course, it was only a couple of hundred years ago, we didn't even have hospitals. So all of that caring was done in the home and it was done by women. So, and these women survived. They didn't have type 2 diabetes. They didn't have obesity. They didn't get dementia. So all of these diseases that are so often linked to sleep, that's been a little bit overblown. And it needs to be researched in much more detail. And it needs to be unpicked a bit, because I think it's multifactorial. I think all of those things, the growth of metabolic disease, it isn't just about not getting enough sleep. And in fact, when it comes to women, it doesn't seem to be anything to do with sleep at all. And so there are quite a few studies out there now that show that women who don't sleep well have absolutely no greater risk of dementia, nothing at all. In fact, the lack of sleep doesn't really affect them, but it is a slightly different issue for men who are more affected by it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And it does make a lot of sense from a biological standpoint, right? As you're mentioning, women have always been the caretakers. Biologically, we're having baby after baby, our sleep is going to be broken. And, you know, we started the year, Ali and I, with a coaching episode on stress. And I believe that stress is, that's what's harming us more than anything, right? Like there is so much Absolutely. Emphasis on food or movement or sleep. But again, right, like the stress on our bodies can lead to the lack of sleep or lead to lack of whatever it may be. I think stress is really harming us. And it's, you know, I think loss and grief is very real and can put a tremendous amount of stress on our bodies. And this concept, right, that again, Ali and I were so interested in when we were talking about your book and off recording, you know, almost like leaning into your insomnia, as you were just talking about, right? Like this creativity bloomed, this, you know, this new night self, as I think you called it in your book, yeah. This night self emerged. And so I'm curious, just did embracing that night self, like, I guess my two questions are, did that help your grief? And did it also ultimately help your insomnia?
Yeah, it helped both. So first of all, it helped the grief because I wasn't expressing anything by day. So by day, I was trying to be superwoman. And so night was the only space. And the dark, there's something really freeing about being in the dark. You know, first of all, no one can see you. You can't see yourself. You never see yourself in a mirror and think, oh God, look at the state of me. And of course, when you're not sleeping, you're grieving, you're not looking great. So it's really nice to feel anonymous and to feel the darkness felt like a huge blanket that I can just wrap myself up in and no one would see me. And it was just me in the darkness. And I just had this feeling that the darkness just doesn't judge you. It just holds you. And it's a really strange feeling. But once I had accepted that was, you know, that was what it was, and I needed the darkness for whatever reason, I started to really, really enjoy my nights. And so that brings me to your point, really. I think when you're lying awake at night and you're stressing, I think the stress is what is so utterly exhausting. So I would find that the next morning I'd wake up and perhaps I hadn't had much sleep, but I had my little drawings and I had my little poems, whatever, you know, my lyrics, whatever I've been writing. And I didn't feel half as tired as on the nights when I was ruminating and I was getting upset and angry and just, I think, just my body just flooding with cortisol when cortisol really shouldn't be there. So at night, it's really important to stay calm. And I think your other point, which is so absolutely spot on, is that, you know, we're told by the sleep industry that sleep is the panacea for everything. Yeah, that's the medicine. But actually, stress is the problem. It's not sleep that's the problem. It's the stress you're experiencing. So just, you know, spending money on another new mattress and some more supplements, it's just like putting a Band-Aid over a knife wound. You know, you need to sort out what it is that's making you wake up all the time and stopping you from going back to sleep. And that is the issue, not the sleep. Once you've sorted that, the sleep will come.
Yeah. It makes sense. And it had me reflecting on my own sleep too. And I do typically sleep quite well. You know, I get my 8 hours and I love it. I'm a good sleeper. So knock on wood, but there are these occasional nights that, and your writing really had me thinking about those occasional nights in my life where, you know, it's that 4 a.m. eyes pop open and all of the worries of the world are in your mind. And the fight that I've had with myself to just go back to sleep. And 2 hours later, I'm still on that same pattern, which is what you're talking about, that stress. And my husband has this thing when it happens to him, and he shared it with me too. And I've done it and it helps. It's what you're talking about. It's that leaning in, like, get up, go do something, go to a different space. And as you said, like, there's this darkness, there's this stillness, like the rest of the world around you is asleep. And it's when I've done that, that either like intense creative ideas have come. Erica and I have a children's book series around nutrition and gut health that we're developing. And one night I woke up, I was in a, like one whole book kind of just came to me, and I like came to her with it like 9 a.m. after that night. Or you're not fighting yourself and you have that ability to just like, that's when I can fall back. And maybe it's on the couch or maybe it's on a different bed or something, but it's like, it's that stress that keeps, and then you feel like this is like wasted time. I don't know. That's something that I've experienced. Yeah. So you like really exploring this made me really reflect on those moments. Fortunately, it's very few and far between, but like there have been these moments.
We want to take a quick break from this episode to tell you about today's sponsor, Sprout Living. One of our favorite new snacks are Sprout Living's probiotic almonds. Wildly delicious and irresistibly crunchy, these are the perfect gut healthy balanced snack. Each pack of the sprouted and activated organic almonds contain 10 billion CFUs of probiotics, 6 grams of clean plant protein, and a variety of other superfood spices and herbs that do the body good.
They're made without seed oils, which we all know are out, and the flavors. The Italian truffle is unreal delicious, and the dairy-free cheddar cheese made with turmeric and nutritional yeast always hits the spot. Honestly, we may never have another chip again. Sprout Living also makes our favorite plant-based protein blends. I use the chocolate maca almost every day.
If you want to try Sprout Living, you can save 20% off your entire order by using code COURAGEOUS at checkout. Visit www.sproutliving.com and use code COURAGEOUS to save 20%. Give them a try and let us know if you love them as much as we do. You can also find direct links in the show notes. Now back to the episode. The way you also bring in other kind of women through history to talk about some of what writing has been done. And one of the things that also really interested me is you brought in some sort of spiritual communities that have been studied. And can you share with our listeners, of course, we want people to go out and read the book, but can you just tease a little bit about those findings too? Because many spiritual communities, monks, nuns, would get up to pray in the middle of the night and have this sort of segmented sleep through their rituals purposefully. And can you talk to us a little bit about what your findings were in that?
Yes. So historically, lots of people slept biphasically. So it was quite normal to sleep in two chunks. And they would quite often, people would get up in the middle of the night and they would just go and do things. They would go visit friends, you know, strange things, but they would go visit friends. They'd, you know, wander around, they'd go for a little walk. So that was quite normal. But in the nunneries and the monasteries where they were following what's known as the canonical hours, so this is the Catholic Church, they would pray. They had to pray every 3 hours. So they would have a midnight service, and then they would all get up again at 3 a.m. And the 3 a.m. service was their longest service of all of the 7 praying sessions throughout the day and night. And that was because that service was deemed really important, because that was when they felt they could get closest to God. So the 3 a.m. service was the most special, most lengthy one. And then again, then they would get up at 6 a.m. and then they'd do it again. So this 3 hour sort of living in this strange cycles of 3 hours with these very spiritual intervals. And I was really interested in this, in the 3 a.m. one, and the fact that it was accorded so much importance, and it was a sort of thought as the most divine of all of the different hours. And of course, then they've gone in since then. This is coming back to more modern times. They've gone in and looked at what is happening in the brains of monks and nuns during that particular 3 a.m. Sort of praying session. And people often seem to find that one particularly spiritual. And there's something about 3 a.m. It was called the hour of God. It's perhaps the most silent part of the night, when it's pretty quiet at 3 a.m. Pretty quiet at 3 a.m. Even at 4, sometimes the birds are starting, but 3 a.m. has a very, very magical quality, and it's partly the silence and partly perhaps some of the chemicals that are going around in the brain. So one of the chemicals one of the biochemicals I looked at is this, it's called dimethyltryptamine, DMT, which is now really known because it's part of the whole ayahuasca thing in South America. But the researchers I spoke to said, look, we all produce our own DMT. It's very, very small quantities, but they think that DMT is what causes dreaming. So that's why it's that, you know, you have dreams are like hallucinations, aren't they? You don't really know where they've come from. They often don't make any sense. One of the researchers said, look, it's circadian. DMT is circadian. So we start producing that at night. So if you're awake at 3 a.m., you are going to be feeling more spiritual, maybe more hallucinatory, more out of this world, more other. And he said that is probably why this has always been experienced as such a sort of spiritual time. And I suspect it's maybe that, I don't know, but it's probably that and perhaps a combination just with the silence, because you're right bang in the middle of the night there.
Yeah. I think that's so interesting. Actually, my dad always told me, actually, and my dad's not really like a woo-woo kind of person. I am, my parents do, I will say. My parents have been practicing Buddhism for 40 years. It's how Ali and I actually met, is through our Buddhist practice. But even with my father's practice of Buddhism, I would never ever call my dad like a woo-woo guy. And he always told me, he's like, if you're up in the middle of the night, like he's told me this since I was a little kid, like if you're up at like 3 a.m, go chant or go pray. And it's something I've always done. Like if I do find myself awake, I'll chant to myself, or because it's just kind of stuck with me. And since I've become more like woo-woo and spiritual as I've grown up and aged, I've heard that from so many different people in different, there is like this veil of something at 3 a.m. that can be really powerful across cultures. And so, yeah. And who knows where my dad even heard that, he's not, but I find that really, really cool and interesting. I do have a question, because, my sister-in-law is actually, a nurse in oncology. She works with ICU patients and she does the night shift. So her hours are typically 7 to 7. So right. Her circadian rhythm is on another level, because she is working through the night, right? Like she's very awake. And so I'm curious how this can apply to anyone listening who might be in that kind of phase where maybe they're sleepless because they do work a night shift or a graveyard shift, or they're nurses or doctors or in the medical field, which we've done episodes on that kind of stress, mm-hmm. which is, I feel like, its own beast, but I'm curious if there is anything you found or if there's anything that you can even lean into, because there's still, I know she's told me there's still quiet moments, you know, during those shifts, because
yes,
a lot of the patients are sleeping, you know, during that time. But I'm curious for anybody who maybe is dealing with insomnia or dealing with sleep issues because of maybe their work or their lifestyle in a different way. What would you say to any one of those listeners?
Well, one of the things I did discover going back through the sort of the history of sleep was that people have always worked through the night. So the idea that this is just a modern shift work is just a modern thing, it's just not the case. So women have always worked, midwives and doctors, when there were no hospitals, midwives and doctors serving their community would just work, you know, through the night, through the day, whatever was required. And around the same time, so I'm going back now to about probably about 300 or 400 years ago, every community, certainly in Europe, had a night watchman. So there were always people literally working through the night. People had no alarm clocks, so you would pay someone to come and wake you up. There were people who would go around and they'd tap on your window. That, you know, a village might have one clock, and the night watchman had it, or the clockman had it. And so, and bakers, you know, I come from a line of bakers, which is probably why I don't sleep very well. Bakers always started their day at 3 a.m. So the idea that that shift work is just a modern phenomenon is not true. There have always been people that have worked nights. And that probably explains why some people have different, different clocks, really, different chronobiologies. So I suspect most people working the night shift are probably more night owlish than sort of larkish. And it may be that they can cope with it really well because they have a gene that enables them to function quite well in the night. So the first thing I would say is, you know, don't, this, I think there's quite a lot of, scaremongering. Or maybe a scaremonger is not the right word, but there's quite a lot of, you know, dictates, isn't there? You should go to bed at 10 and you must have 8 hours sleep. And, you know, you've got to be regular as clockwork. And I think there's truth in some of that. But I also think that we're all different and we all cope with things very, very differently. And some people are really good at night and perform really well. And some people are useless at night. So I guess I would say, you need to sort of work out where you sit, where your clock is. And then a lot of the people I know who do the night shift really like it. They say it's quiet, it's peaceful, there's an intimacy to it. You can spend a bit more time with people. So yeah, that's sort of not a very good answer to your question, but...
No, it's helpful. And it's sort of this idea. And I think it's actually like, it's really important to kind of draw attention to in the concept of like our wellness practices overall too, in a more general way, is that oftentimes there is so much sort of marketed to us about what is right or what is normal or what is optimal for health. And maybe there's some validity in that, but to not forget that we are bio-individual creatures and that, like you said, if you come from a line of bakers, there might be something where it's like, maybe it's easier for you to be up at what we would consider odd hours or, and maybe vice versa for others. I've always thought like I never really understood night owls because I get up naturally early. I'm a morning person, you know, and I do my best work in the morning. And then the afternoon I'm from, you know, afternoon to early evening, I'm a little bit useless later in the day. And then sometimes there's like a bit of a, you know, a little bit of a kind of, after that dip, there's a little bit kind of energy and then it's like, I'm out, you know? So, but I have friends who do their best work and their best thought, like starting around 11 PM. I know many writers and it, you know, I think writers in particular, sometimes as you show in the book as well, that like some of the greatest writers we have, did a lot in the night and wrote a lot in the night. And these ideas, you know, the veil that we're talking about, whether it's from like the spiritual perspective or the creative perspective, is a little bit thinner in those hours. And I always thought that was like quite fascinating because I didn't have that in that way. But it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And it doesn't mean that everybody doesn't have their own sort of optimal way to be. So thank you for sharing this and exploring this in this way, because I think sometimes we're fed these things where it's like, this is what you have to do, or this is best. And that just can create more stress if you're trying to, you know, fit yourself in a hole that doesn't necessarily work for you. And so I think, you know, exploring ideas like this give people the opportunity to really explore what is the best, what is the most optimal kind of, what are the most optimal choices for them at that season of their life, right? Like this is something that increased for you in grief and became something that was in some ways a benefit for you. So, and that we're allowed to kind of go through different seasons, and that can apply to all different aspects of our health as well. So,
yes. Yes. No, I think you're absolutely right. And I think there's often a tendency, even in sort of our own health industry, to be quite dictatorial about, you know, how you should live your life. But in fact, and if you think about all the things that are constantly changing, I mean, just what was it? About 100 years ago, we all thought smoking cigarettes was good for us, and doctors would say smoking is good for you. Mm-hmm. So all these things are, you know, sort of, they have to be reviewed, and they have to be, some of them have to be then thrown out.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was just reading last night that Eric and I have done some episodes on this, but the World Health Organization, like for a long time now, has considered alcohol to be like class one carcinogen. And like, yeah, there's more of this sober curious movement, and there's like, you know, exploration of consuming less alcohol as kind of like culturally, I think for the first time in a very, very long time. But it's like, you know, you're still getting a ton of headlines that say like, drink red wine for your heart health. And it's like, well, maybe we need to review some of these things, because like berries also have polyphenols, right? Like there's just like some more complexity and nuance to many sort of things that have been dogmatically like given as health sort of standards for a long time.
Yes. Yeah. That's a good word. I think health dogma.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for sharing with us today and for this book. And as we start to wrap up, we ask our guests three wrap-up questions. So I'll start with the first. What do you do to take care of yourself on a daily basis? Do you have any daily self-care practices or non-negotiables?
Yes, absolutely. I think I heard you talk about it on an earlier podcast, but I completely agree. It's get out first thing in the morning. You know, as soon as I'm up, I get outside, and it's movement and sunlight as soon as I can. So normally that would be within 40 minutes of waking up. I would be outside, walk. Usually for me, it's walking, occasionally running, but being really active. No sunglasses, you know, sunlight straight to the eye. That is absolutely non-negotiable. No processed. I've never eat processed food. That is sort of pretty non-negotiable, pretty much. Never any ultra processed food. So generally I cook from scratch. That's non-negotiable. I think those are the two. And in fact, I do actually, I'm really careful about my sleep, oddly enough. So I do have really low light. You could probably see now that I'm sitting, you can probably see I've got some candles there. So from about 8 o'clock in the evening, I just have very, very low light, never overhead, nothing blue. Normally I might even be wearing my weird blue blocking glasses. I'm quite vigilant about that. So in fact, I'll just quickly drop this in. One of the studies that appeared about 3 months ago was all about darkness and how women in particular really need complete darkness at night. Mm. So no light, no flickering television, no little blue Wi-Fi lights. It needs to be completely dark. And that is where, again, men and women are different. And the guy I spoke to said he thought it was because for hundreds and thousands of years, women went into caves at night to sleep and to protect their own children. So for thousands of years, we slept with really pitch black darkness at night. And we still seem to need that.
Yeah, it is so interesting because we can learn so much from history and, you know, just our biological evolution, right? Like we talk about this from the standpoint of, again, back to stress all the time. Our bodies can't differentiate a stressful email from being chased by a predator because we just haven't advanced as quickly as we've advanced, you know, from a biological standpoint. So it makes so much sense. And again, thank you for sharing all of this with us today. And this is why everyone needs to go and buy your book. But the second question we always ask is, what does being courageous mean to you?
I think it means leaning into things that are uncomfortable and embracing the discomfort and just going with it, not being scared of being outside of our comfort zones or of being in uncomfortable situations, but you know, just accept that discomfort is part of the human condition.
Thank you. And then the final question is, in addition to your own book, of course, is there a book you would recommend to our audience? It can be on any topic, but just something that means something personal to you.
I really like Wintering by Catherine May. It's about leaning into winter and sort of accepting that sometimes we need to hibernate. And sometimes we need to take ourselves out of our sort of busy, everyday, frantic social lives. And we just need to stay home and bake for a few weeks.
I'm going to check that out because I've been chatting with Erica and I was like, I just feel like I need to hibernate. And it's very strange because in Southern California, we barely have a seasonal shift. I mean, it's cooler and then it's warmer and that's basically it, but it's like sunny most of the time. So you don't give yourself the same kind of permission, I think, to curl up and hibernate in the winter. So I'm going to definitely check that out. If anybody wants to find you, follow you, buy your books, where can they do that?
I have a website, which is www.annabelleabs.com. I'm on Instagram at Annabelle Abbs, and the book Sleepless can be bought in any bookshop, I hope.
Thank you so much again for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Courageous Wellness. Tune in every Wednesday for a new episode featuring a different guest each week. Subscribe, rate, and write us a nice review. And you can also follow us on Instagram at Courageous Wellness or get in touch via our website, www.courageouswellness.net, where you can also find additional info about our health coaching services, virtual group events, newsletter, and more. Until next week, I'm Allie.
And I'm Erica, and we're Courageous Wellness.